So we're Parshas Eschanan, that's on page 958. Just before we start, today's shir is dedicated to Dvora Bat Yaakov, whose yahrzeit is today. And we should have Aliyas and Hashama should be elevated, and only good things. Just let's begin as we sometimes do, which is an overview of the Parsha. So it's an action-packed Parsha, as the book of Dvarim is. So we begin the Parsha with reading about Moshe Rabbeinu's prayer to enter the land of Israel. We learn from the gematria of the word of Eschanan, means our prayer, that was 515, that he actually davened 515 times to go into the land of Israel. And Hashem then said, you have to stop, because if you daven more, I'm going to have to let you in. Power of prayer. And Hashem didn't want him to go into the land of Israel, so he had to stop. Then there's a large section reminding us once again, as the theme of the book of Devarim is, to keep and commit to all the mitzvahs, be aware of the consequences of not keeping the mitzvahs, and so on and so forth. Also together with the reminder of the whole experience of Mount Sinai, which Moshe Rabbeinu reminds the generation. Again, it's the generation that's going to the land of Israel, who is not the generation that stood at Har Sinai. It's the later generations, the next generation. Interestingly enough, the part that we read about that actually is the Torah reading that we read on Tisha B'Av morning. It comes from this parsha, and it's always the same. It's always in the week of Eschanan, and we read the coming from Eschanan, that piece. Then we have a warning against idol worship, a warning about the consequence of not serving Hashem. We have a part of the cities of refuge that comes in a few times in the Torah. We just had it a few weeks ago, actually, in Parshas Maaseh, but it comes again in this week's Parsha. It's part of Devarim, as part of the repetition of the Chumash. We have the Ten Commandments, again, for the second time. Because it's Mishnah Torah, it's the repetition of the Torah, so Moshe Rabbeinu repeats the Ten Commandments. Interestingly enough, they're almost identical to the first, although there are differences between the first and the second. One of the most notable differences is the one to do with Shabbos. That in the first Ten Commandments, it says in Parshas Yisro, when it was given, it says Zochar Hashem HaShabbos, to remember the Shabbos. In this Parsha, it says Shomer Hashem HaShabbos, guard the Shabbos, protect the Shabbos. You know that Zochar and Shomer is the positive and the negative of Shabbos. Zochar is the things you're supposed to do to honor the Shabbos, like make Kiddush and good food and clothing and all the other things that come with it. Shomer is the negatives, what we're not supposed to do on Shabbos, and so on and so forth. And of course, the Gemara asks, Which one did Hashem actually say at Mount Sinai? And we have the famous answer. He said both words simultaneously, which is something that a human being cannot do, but Hashem did it. He said both words at the same time, because both concepts are an integral part of the Shabbos experience. Then we have the Shema, which is the first paragraph of Shema. Then we have a pasuk talking about remembering the going out of Egypt and communicating it to our children. It's one of the four times in the Torah. You know, on Seder night we have four sons, right? Which we respond to each one differently. The four sons is not a made-up thing that the Haggadah made up. The four sons is actually based on the mitzvah of communicating to our children the story of Exodus in Egypt. And there's four times in the Torah where it tells us to do that. And the Chazal tell us that the four times represents the four different types of children. And we learn from each one how he's supposed to respond to each one. So one of them is in this week's Parsha. And then, just at the end of the parasha, we have again more encouragement and more about our commitment to Hashem and to remain faithful to Him and to His mitzvahs. Okay. So what I thought this week, we could do something just a little bit different, instead of going in so much to the parasha, I mean it's part of the parasha, is since this parasha actually has the Shema, and I thought the Shema is something that we keep on saying, we say every single day, so I thought we'd actually go into the Shema, at least the first sentence, and if we get time, maybe the second sentence as well, being that it's part of the parasha. I think it would be just good to delve into the Shema to understand what is it that we say every day, right? Before we do that, just to mention, of course, that this Shabbos is also a special Shabbos because the Haftorah is a special Haftorah, and it's the Haftorah of Nachamu, the Haftorah of comfort. During the 3 weeks, we have the three Haftorahs of reprimand, and during the next 7 weeks, we have seven Haftorahs of comfort, like a double measure of comfort. And that's why we start off the Haftorah this week with the pasuk that says, Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, be comforted, my nation, which is a double measure of comfort. And that goes now for the next 7 weeks, until Rosh Hashanah, where we have, until the week before Rosh Hashanah, where we have 7 weeks of comfort. Okay. So we know that the Pasuk of Shema, I'll just show you where it is in the Chumash, although I did actually print it on the handout, so you actually don't need it in the Chumash, but it doesn't matter. I'll just show you where it is anyway. It's at the bottom of page 972. So that where you see at the bottom there, it says Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and then Ve'ahavta Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha b'nashma b'chol me'edecha. Of course, the sentence Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus El Avod is not a pasuk in the Torah, right? And it was put in by the rabbis as part of Shema, but that came later. It's actually not part of the original Shema. And if we get time, we'll be able to talk about that. Now, as we said, the Shema is a fundamental pasuk in the Torah. It's the verse that Yidden have lived and died by throughout all the ages, right? It's the pasuk, the Shema. So let's just understand a couple of things. First of all, let's understand the Shema on a halachic level. So on a halachic level, there's a mitzvah, it says in the Torah, there's a mitzvah to read the Shema twice a day. When we talk about reading the Shema, we talk about the three paragraphs of the Shema, but the truth is that the fundamental mitzvah is the first paragraph, not all three paragraphs. And in fact, according to some halachic opinions, within the first paragraph, you fulfill the mitzvah just by reading the first pasuk, just the sentence of Shema Yisrael, right? So, the mitzvah is to read the Shema in the morning and to read the Shema in the evening, right? Morning and night. Now, it has certain restrictions about when you can read it. You're supposed to read it before a certain amount of time in the morning. You're supposed to read it at night after it's gone dark, and so on and so forth. That's the halachic obligation. Interestingly enough, women don't actually have the same obligation in terms of reading the Shema, because the way the mitzvah is given in the Torah to read the Shema, it's a time-bound mitzvah. It needs to be read in a specific time. It needs to be read within the first 3 hours of the morning and at night after it gets dark. So it becomes a mitzvah sasei she'azman gram. It's a time-bound mitzvah, which technically women are absolved from. However, the Shulchan Aruch is very clear that women still have to read the Shema every day, because apart from the technical mitzvah of when to read it and how to read it in the morning and evening and all that, there's the importance of reading the Shema every day as a means of confirming and affirming our commitment to Hashem and crowning Him as King over ourselves and over the universe, right? So therefore it becomes an obligation everyone to read the Shema. Although for women, it doesn't matter exactly when the Shema is read; it doesn't have to be in the right time necessarily, as long as it's read every single day. And the minhag is to read it at night as well. So men and women read it both and day and night.
Okay. Does your bedtime Shema?
Yeah, it could. For example, some people, like even with regard to the male obligation of reading the Shema, often during the summer particularly, not only the summer, but even summer particularly, many communities have a custom to daven Maariv early, right? So they'll do Mincha Maariv together. Every day, I'm saying just a daily thing. Now, daven Maariv, which you're allowed to, and that's a whole other discussion why you can daven Maariv early, provided it's a certain time, and part of Maariv is the Shema, right? But if you do that, it doesn't count for the mitzvah Shema. For example, many shuls do that on a Friday night during the summer, right? They'll have Maariv and they'll have Lamida and the Shema and everything. But actually that Shema is good. It still counts as part of davening, but doesn't count as the mitzvah of fulfilling the mitzvah of reading the Shema. And therefore it's important when people come home after it gets dark to reread it, right? And many people rely on the bedtime Shema to be able to do that. Okay, so
the ladies also not obligated for Maariv.
They're not obligated in the Shema in its right time. But they should say the bedtime Shema. They should say Shema at night, just as a means of
remembering
and to crown Hashem as King over us and so on.
So that first paragraph
is the key. Although if you're only doing the bedtime Shema, in other words, if that's the only Shema you're doing at night, it's probably better to do all three paragraphs. Yeah, that's what it says. Okay. And what is the Shema? So the Gemara says, for example, the Shema is actually, it's interesting that in Gemara Rosh Hashanah, right, we're coming up to Rosh Hashanah soon, you know, Rosh Hashanah, when we daven Musaf, we have three special blessings. It's a unique Amidah. The Musaf of Shemoneh Esrei got three special middle blessings. Malchius, Zichronus, and Shofres, the bracha of kingdom, Hashem's sovereignty, the bracha of remembering, and the bracha of Shofar, right? Now when it comes to each bracha, you'll remember that the structure, remember from last year, we almost said it again, but you remember that the structure of that special Amidah of Musaf is different to all other Shemoneh Esreis, in that normally we just daven, but on Rosh Hashanah we actually quote 10 verses as part of the bracha. It's almost like a proof to Hashem that He has to be our King, or He has to remember us, or He has to accept our shofar, so to speak, right? So there's 10 verses, and the Gemara, and there's a whole criteria of which verses you choose. So when it comes to the way we do it, the minhag is, the way we do it is, that when it comes to the bracha of sovereignty, for example, we'll say three psukim from the Torah that deal with Hashem's sovereignty, three psukim from ksuvim, like from the later part of Tanakh, then three psukim of the Nevi'im, the prophets, and then we end off with a Torah pasuk. That's how it's right. And the same thing is remembrance, same thing is in Shofar. So when it comes to the Malchus, when the Gemara gives the criteria of all the psukim, we don't have enough psukim. And when it comes to the 10th one, there's a bit of an issue about what to say for the 10th pasuk, because we don't have a pasuk in the Torah that mentions the word Hashem as king, following the criteria that the Gemara says you need for those brachas. So the Gemara says what you do is you just say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. You'll see in the Musaf of Shemoneh Esrei of Rosh Hashanah, we say Shema Yisrael as part of the kingdom, because the Gemara says saying the Shema, that is kingdom. It doesn't say the word Melech, but saying Shema Yisrael Hashem is our God, Hashem is one, really is about accepting upon ourselves not just belief in a God, but believing in the authority of God and the sovereignty of God. And we'll see why that is part of the pasuk a bit later. But it's about crowning Hashem over us as a king. In fact, the Gemara says, why is it the first and second paragraph in that order? That's a Mishnah that asks that question. Why is the first paragraph before the second paragraph? Now you might wonder, it's a strange question, because in the Torah it's that way. The first paragraph of Shema is this week's parasha, the second paragraph of Shema is next week's parasha, right? So we actually say it in order. But we actually don't, because the Shema has three paragraphs, and the third paragraph is completely out of order. The third paragraph comes from Bamidbar, right? So we've learned that already. So what the Mishnah really means is, why when the rabbis told us to do the mitzvah of Shema, and they didn't necessarily follow the order of the Torah, which you see from the third paragraph, so why did they tell us, why is the Shema paragraph before the second paragraph? And the answer the Mishnah gives is as follows, that when you commit to a king, you need two levels of commitment. As we call Kabbalas ol Malchus Shemaim and Kabbalas ol Mitzvahs. One commitment is a general commitment to the king, to become subservient to the king, without any specifics. It's just we commit to you, whatever you're going to tell us, it's not relevant, we are just yours, we are your faithful subjects. Then, as an extension of that, becomes, okay, now that we're your faithful subjects, what do we need to do? And then we commit ourselves to the specific mitzvahs. Right? That's called Kabbalas ol Mitzvahs, accepting upon ourselves the yoke of mitzvahs. So the Gemara, the Mishnah says that the first paragraph of Shema is a general acceptance of Hashem's sovereignty. That's what Shema is. No, not specifics, although we mentioned some specifics in the first paragraph, but generally the emphasis in the first paragraph, and particularly the first few sentences, is just a general commitment to Hashem as our king. The second paragraph deals much more with specific and specific mitzvahs, and that's why it comes the second after the first. Now, just to give you a little bit of an insight before we go into the actual pasuk of Shema, just to give you a bit of insight to how important the Shema is, we know that when we daven every day, so generally speaking, and the Rambam talks about this a lot, generally speaking, a important part of davening is kavanah. Kavanah means to have intention, to have focus, right? To know what we're saying. I mean, there's kavanah on many levels. There's a famous halachic concept that comes from Reb Chaim of Brisk, and he talks about the two levels of kavanah in davening. One is general kavanah, just when you daven to know and to be conscious before whom we stand, and then the specific kavanah about what we actually say. Now, the halacha is that if you daven without kavanah, especially the specific kavanah, so you daven the whole amidah, you don't know what you're saying, or you daven the whole davening, you don't know what you're saying, you still fulfill the mitzvah of davening. Okay? In other words, although kavanah is very, very important, but it doesn't prevent you from filling the mitzvah of davening. Especially if you have the general kavanah that you just try your best and you know before whom you're staying and you might not understand everything and so on and so forth, but it's fine. There are only three places we are taught in davening where specific kavanah is essential. One is a verse in Ashrei. I don't know if you're aware of this, but it's interesting to know. It's in Ashrei, when we say Ashrei, there's one verse where we talk about Hashem being the source of all sustenance. That's a sentence in Ashrei. There you're supposed to stop and actually have in mind specifically what it means. Hashem opens up, we praise Hashem for opening up His hand and feeding all the living things according to their needs and desires. Right? That's one place. The second place is the Shema, the first sentence of the Shema. That just shows you how important it is. And the third is the first blessing of the Amidah. To the point where the halacha is, if you forgot to have intention by Shema, you're supposed to repeat it. Actually, you're supposed to go back and read it again, because you don't fulfill the mitzvah of Shema unless you have that kavanah. The truth is, in the Amidah, it's also the halacha, If you finish the Shemoneh Esrei and you know you didn't have to think about the meaning of the first bracha, you're really supposed to do it again. Although halacha is that today we don't do it because we have such a fantastic attention span that the chances are the second time around it's not going to be much better. So therefore, that's a bracha. We don't want to say a bracha in vain. So therefore, we just try our best the next time. But the halacha remains, however, that kavana is essential in those three places. So it just gives you a bit of an insight of how important the first sentence of Shema is and to actually know what it means, right? Also, the way we say it, like, you know, if you daven, it's, I'm just giving you just various halachas just to show you the importance of Shema. If you daven, for example, you didn't say the words grammatically correctly and you weren't so careful of maybe one word running into another word or whatever the case is, it's not the end of the world. With Shema it is. With Shema you have to be very careful. It says in the Mishnah that with Shema you're supposed to say it slowly, say each word carefully, make sure one word doesn't go into the other. Like, you know, there's certain words the halacha says in the whole of Shema where a word ends with the same letter that the next word begins, like b'chol levavcha, right? So if you say it quickly, then you won't only say one lamed, b'chol levavcha, you only say one lamed. So that's how you're supposed to break between the two words, b'chol levavcha, b'chol levavchem. Just various halachas that we read in Shemoneh Esrei in Shulchan Aruch about how the Shema is supposed to be recited, just to show you how important the recitation of the Shema actually is.
But, Rabbi, yeah. Can you just say that again? You're saying that if you haven't got the intention, but even if you are there where there's not much connection, there's one way which I'm afraid for me.
Look, we all have that problem, but you just have to try your best. But where one should put extra effort is in the first sentence of the Shema, six words. Just to stop and say it slowly, and to have in mind what it actually means, which we're going to go through and try and understand what we're supposed to have in mind, and what actually does it mean. Right? Oh no, I mean the same thing again. The first bracha. No, the first bracha. You're right. When we're in a rush, we don't do it. But and it's always better to say it than not to say it, because when a person davens, it's always a commitment, and God finds that very precious. So just the fact that we open up a siddur, we even say the words without even thinking, that's already a commitment, and that's great. But if we want to know, if we want to start and trying to improve our davening, we know that there's three places to start with, and that's those three sentences. And the first bracha of Shemoneh Esrei, just say it a bit slow and try and at least glance at the English or try and understand what it means. And then the same thing with the first sentence of Shema. Okay. So so if that's so important, so what actually are we supposed to think? What does it actually mean, Shemoneh Esrei? What are we supposed to have in mind when we read the Shema, right? So, I think the starting point is, let me share with you what it says in Shulchan Aruch, because it's a halachic matter, really, in a way. So before we go into the commentaries and the deeper levels and deeper layers of what it all means, let's simply have a look at what it says in the Code of Jewish Law, in Shulchan Aruch, about what one is supposed to think as a translation of Shema. So the first part is a general concept about what the names of God mean. Right? Because in the Pasuk of Shema, we say Hashem Elokeinu Hashem. We say the name of God three times, right? We say Hashem Elokeinu and Hashem. So what does it actually mean? What are the names of God various mean? We know that the names of God are various manifestations of God. The Midrash tells us that God in essence doesn't have a name because God is indescribable. He can't really be described. But the names of God, and that's why God has many names, there are various times where God chooses to manifest himself or to express himself in certain ways, right? And therefore, there's different aspects of God's expression and God's manifestation which is expressed and embedded into the names. Now, when it comes to the name of Hashem, we say Shema Yisrael Hashem, so if you have a look at the Chumash, right, at the bottom of page 972, like always, when we say a bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem, right? Or Shema Yisrael Hashem. So the name of Hashem is written Yud and a Hey and a Vav and a Hey, right? Although, and that's the holiest name of Hashem. What we are not permitted to do until Mashiach comes, we don't say it that way, right? So the way we say it and the way it's written is different. When we say the name of God, this one, all the other names of God, we say it as it's written. But this name of God, we don't say as it's written. We say a different form. We say Adnut. We use the word of Adon, right? Master. Adon and then Nai, right? I don't want to say the whole thing because you're not supposed to say it. But it's the expression. It's the God's name which comes to the word Adon, which means master. So therefore, the Shulchan Aruch tells us that when we say the name of God generally, but particularly in Shema where Kavanah is essential, we're supposed to have in mind both names and the meanings of both names. Both the ones that we say and the ones that is written. Because what we're saying is actually we're reading in a different way what is written, but what is written is different to what we say. Is that clear? Yeah? So he's supposed to have in mind both meanings. What is both meanings? So the name of Hashem, Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, represents the omnipresence of Hashem, because what it actually, it's made out of three words. In the name of Hashem, Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey, you can find the words Haya, Hover and Yeh, was, is, and will be. So in other words, it's the infinity of God, the omnipresence of God and the omnipotence of God, essentially. God is an infinite being who is beyond the definitions of time and restrictions of time and space. Right? But then that's how it's written. That's how we have in mind in terms of written. And then when we say it, we say Adnut, we say Adoshem, which means Adon, that he's the master of everything. And that's the translation of Shema Yisrael. Shema Yisrael means listen, Israel. We'll go more into what that means in a second, but on a simple level, it means just Moshe Rabbeinu is talking to the Jewish people and he's saying, Shema Yisrael, listen, Jewish people. Hashem means he was, is, and will be omnipotent, omnipresent. He's also our master. Elokeinu. Now, what's Elokeinu? Elokeinu comes from the name of God of Elohim, the only name of God that's conjugated. Elokeinu means our God, our Elohim. And Elohim refers to the might and the power of God. So Adon is that he's our master. Elohim, simply, halachically, what it means is, it's talking about his absolute ability and his power and his might in the upper worlds and the lower worlds. Okay. So we say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem who's our God, and we have in mind what that means, Elokeinu. He is Hashem Echad, he's one God. Now what does that mean, one God? Okay. So again, now right now I'm just following the layer of halachics. But even on the simple level of purely translating this word halachically, to have in mind that Hashem Echad means he's the only God is incorrect. Because it's much, much more than that. Right? Simply reading, when a person translates the word Hashem Echad means one God, means no other gods. But that's not correct, and that's not why we say Shema. Means, of course, it's correct. I mean, it's not the correct translation only, right? Because we wouldn't have to say the Shema twice a day to convince ourselves that God's the only God. That's a fairly obvious thing. It's not such a difficult thing to come to terms that there's only one God. So the reason that we have to say Shema twice a day, and the reason that we have to completely contemplate and reflect on it the whole time, is because Hashem Echad has a deeper translation on many levels. Even on a simple halachic level, Hashem Echad, the word Echad means he's the only authority and he's the only power. It's a bit different. Right? And that's why it says in Shulchan Aruch that the word Echad is supposed to prolong. I don't know if you've heard people say Hashem Echad, right? Now actually, when you say Echad, when you prolong it like that, really what it says is you're supposed to prolong the Chet and the Dalet. Right? Now you can't really prolong the Dalet because it's not that type of a consonant, right? Because if you do that, you'll end up saying it wrong. And some people actually do that. I've heard people do that, and Shulchan Aruch says you shouldn't do that. Like you say, the Chet you can prolong, you can say Echa, right? You can say it as long as you want. The Dalet is a cut-off consonant. If you can't say it long, at least say Echa, but then it's a different consonant. You're saying a D, which it's not written that way. It's a completely silent consonant, right? So what it means, what it says in Shulchan Aruch, that the Dalet is supposed to prolong in thought. Not verbally. So you make the chet a bit longer, like echad, but then you. And in fact, you're supposed to be very careful that the echad is cut off properly, and it's heard that it's a dalid, because God forbid, if you don't say the dalid properly, it could be sound like a resh, and that would say Hashem Acher, another God. That would be the complete extreme opposite of what the intention is. Right? And therefore, it says you should say the echad emphatically, Hashem Echad. Like, you know, you cut a dalet off, right? So what's the prolonging? What's this all about? So first of all, it says that the chet represents the seven heavens and the earth. Because chet has the gematria of eight, right? Now, I should have put this on the paper, but in Shulchan Aruch, there's a very interesting thing. I don't know if you ever saw a chet of a Sefer Torah. I'll draw it for you. This is what a chet looks like. It's like a combination of a vav and zayin, or according to some customs, it's two zayins, whatever, but it's got this like roof on top, right? Different to our chet. That's what it looks like in a Sefer Torah, yeah? What's the idea? So it says in the Shulchan Aruch that it represents the following, that the chet means eight. Eight represents the heavens and the earth. And that when we say achad, we're having in mind that Hashem is the ruler and in complete control of, and He's the master, and we crown Him over the entire world, the heavens and the earth. And that's that roof on top of the chet, representing the divine presence, representing God over the heavens and the earth. That's what it says. Right? And the Dalit, therefore, is the same thing. The Dalit is the four corners of the earth. Right? And as it's brought down other places, that the Aleph, Echad, therefore, is broken up into three. The Aleph stands for God, and also stands for Alufo Shel Olam, the master of the world. Aluf means a world, master. And he's the master, and he's a complete control, and we crown him over the seven heavens and the earth, and the four corners, the four directions. So it's complete subservience to God. So it's much more than just recognizing that He created the world and He's the only God. It's more about us becoming subservient to His authority, and He's the absolute authority and absolute control over everything, all the seven heavens and the earth and the four directions. Okay? Clear? Yeah.
Wait, right. I mean, Zion is seven, but the world is six, so how do you connect it? You said seven.
No. It's the chet. It's the chet together. It's just the shape. This has got nothing to do with the vav and the Zion or the Zion and the Zion.
Okay.
It's just the letter chet has a roof, because that's the idea. That the eight has this roof on top, which means God.
So that chet and zion is not...
Vav and zion has other significance. Not in relation to this concept. Correct. Okay. Now, if you look at the handout that I gave you, and you'll see the shema that I put there, I put the ayin is big and the dalet is big. Okay? Oh, it's big in the, yeah, you're right, it is big in the Chumash as well. Yes, that's correct. Okay. So we know that in the Torah, just generally speaking, just to give you a general introduction, in the Torah there is, throughout Tanakh, there's at least once that every letter of the Aleph Beis is smaller than the word, and at least once that every letter of the Aleph Beis is bigger than the word. Okay. It's called Oisius Zeirin and Oisius Ravravin, small letters and big letters. Meaning, in relation to the average. In other words, whatever shape, whatever size you decide to write your mezuzah, or your Sefer Torah, or your Tanakh, so there's seven, there's at least one place where there's at least letter Aleph Beis bigger and smaller. The Ayin and the Dalet happen to be in Shema, and it's in the mezuzah also like that, and the Sefer Torah, every time we write the Shema, it's like that, that the Ayin of Shema is bigger, and the Dalet is bigger. The simple reason is, as it's brought down in the Gemara, because the word Ayin Dalet means aid, a witness, to testify. Right? And when we say the Shema, there's a pasuk, there's a verse that says, Hashem talks to the Jewish people and He says, Atem Eida, you are my witness. The Jewish people's job is to testify to God's oneness, to God's control, to God's authority in the world. So when we say the Shema, it's like we are bearing testimony, we are testifying to God's presence and His authority and His oneness. And that's what we say when we say Shema, and that's why the Ayin and the Dalet are bigger. We're going to come in a few minutes, we'll give a deeper angle on this whole concept. Now, before we go into some deeper concepts, I want to also just show you what the Rambam says about Hashem Echad. Because that's if we say Shema and we have that in mind, halachically, that's fulfilling the mitzvah. But it goes deeper than that. I'm going to take you one level deeper now. One level deeper is the Rambam. If you have a look on the other side of your handout. Actually, before we do that, go to the front page. I want to show you Rashi. Let's just do Rashi on the Pasuk. Okay, and I put it on the handout in sort of easier letters, so it's easy to read. Rashi comments just to understand, again, the pshat of the Pasuk. What does it mean, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad? Why do we do that, right? So Rashi says an interesting concept. He says, Rashi is the pshat, so what's the pshat of the Pasuk? So let's read it together. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, says Rashi. Hashem Shehu Elokeinu Ata. God, Hashem, who's our God now, V'loy Elokei ha'oved kechavim, and not necessarily the accepted gods of the other nations, meaning He is the God of the other nations, but it means to say He's not recognized necessarily by everyone. So for us now, Hashem Elokeinu, it's our God, we recognize His presence and His authority, but it's not necessarily recognized by everyone. Hu asi liyos Hashem Echad, He will in the future be the one God. As it says in the Pasuk, Oz epoch el amim, when at the end of times Mashiach comes, that God says, I will turn to the entire world, all the nations, Sofa Berura, in a very clear language, Likroi Kulam Mashem Hashem, everyone will call in the name of God. But Nehemiah, as it says in the Pasuk, which we say every day in Aleinu, Bayomahu, in that day, don't know if you remember from Aleinu we say that, but Bayomahu on that day, Yeh Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad. He will be one and his name will be one. Well, his name will be one means a separate issue, but he will be one means, according to Rashi, he will be the accepted authority by every single person. There will not be any being who will not recognize and be fully conscious of God's presence and God's authority when Mashiach comes. And that's how Rashi explains the pasuk. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hashem now is only Hashem Elokeinu, but he will be Hashem Echad. And that's the goal. In other words, we say that every day, but that's what we're working towards. We're working towards publicizing and infusing the world with knowledge and consciousness of his presence. So that's Hashem Elokeinu now, but ultimately the goal is Hashem Echad is the one God of the entire world. Okay. Now if you turn over the page to the other side, the other side of the room. The Rambam, at the very, very beginning of the Rambam, when he talks about the mitzvahs of belief in God, okay, he divides the mitzvahs, the belief in God mitzvah, into two. And they come from two different sukkim, both in this week's parasha actually. The first mitzvah, the Rambam says, is from the pasuk, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem your God, the first one of the Ten Commandments. Says the Rambam, that's the belief that Hashem is one, that Hashem exists, to believe in God. Right? According to the Rambam, that's one of the 613 mitzvahs. That's actually a question whether belief in God is one of the mitzvahs or not. I think I've shared this with you before. There's a bit of a discussion about that. Can belief in God be a mitzvah? Because once you talk about the word mitzvah, by definition, there's already a God. Right? So according to that, Barbanel, I think it is, he says belief in God is not a mitzvah, it's a prerequisite to all mitzvahs. Yet the Rambam does count it as a mitzvah, and that's a whole discussion that takes place. And that mitzvah comes from the pasuk, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem your God. According to the Rambam, there's another mitzvah. And that's in the pasuk of Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. And that's to believe in the oneness of God. Different mitzvah. Now what does it mean to believe in the oneness of God? Because to believe there's only one God, that's not in Hashem Echad. That's already included in Anochi Hashem Elokecha. In other words, in the Ten Commandments we have, I am Hashem your God, you may not have other gods. Which according to the Rambam means a few things. First of all, to believe in God, to serve God, and to believe that there is no other power. Even, and that's all included in the Ten Commandments, even the concept of shittuf. Shittuf means a dual power. Right? B'nai Yisrael, and particularly Jewish people, are not permitted to believe that there's any other power, even a subordinate power, as was the belief among many, many religions or many nations in time gone by. Where they believe that yes, God did create the world. He did. He's ultimately in charge, but he created middle management. So, and he gave autonomy to the stars, to the moon, whatever the case is, or to other powers, and therefore it's befitting for us to serve and to give honor to those middle powers. Right? That is completely the antithesis of fundamental Jewish belief. We believe there is no other power other than God. And even when God sends his blessing or his sustenance or his flow of energy through the constellations and through the stars, which he does, the analogy is given, they are only like a woodchopper chopping a tree. So when a woodchopper chops a tree, he chops it with an axe. Does that mean the axe has any control of what's happening? The axe is just completely controlled by the person. It's a tool that the person is using to chop down the tree. So too, when Hashem gives us things which come, or sometimes come through various different means, like angels or constellations or stars, they have absolutely no control, just tools that Hashem is using to give us what he gives us. Okay, that's all included in Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm Hashem your God, and you shall not have any other gods. So what is the oneness of God? So the Rambam says something interesting. Let's have a look at it. Have a look at the top one, which is Halacha Zayin, right? It says, Elokazeh, this God that you have to believe in, Echad, who is one, ve'eino shnayim, is not two. Although yes, Hashem, not more than two. What does that mean? It doesn't mean there's no other God. It means, Elo Echad she'ein ki yichudai min acharon tzayim ba'olam. It means that he's singular and one in a way that there doesn't exist another kind of oneness like that. It's a difficult thing to understand what this means actually, but what Rambam says is as follows. That the oneness of God means that God is some in the world we talk about one person, right? Or we say there's one guy in charge. He's the only one in charge, right? That one guy is in charge, however, is made up of many components. He's got different parts of him. He's got his brain, he's got the way he thinks, he's got the way he feels, he's got his personality, he's got different limbs of his body. it's many, many compartments, many components that come together and form one entity, right? With Hashem, says the Rambam, you cannot do that. Hashem is indivisible. He's a singular being, indivisible. Because as soon as you start talking about components that come together, you're limiting Him. Because each component has its own definition and own limitation. Right? And therefore the Rambam continues and explains a famous concept which is completely not understood to us because we're human beings, we can't think like that. And he says that. He says it's going to be difficult for you to understand that, but you have to believe it anyway. He says, for example, when a person thinks. So when a person thinks, for example, there's three parts, there's three components. There's me. There's my power of thought, which is separate from me conceptually. There's me and my power to think. I am using my power of thought to think. And then there's the subject matter. Right? All, even within me, they're all three separate components. But Hashem, he says you can't do that. Him and his power of thought and his the subject matter, it's all one thing. It's indivisible. He says, the Rambam says, I know that you're not going to understand exactly what this means, because it's a difficult concept for a human being to process, but that's what the word Hashem Echad means. It's nevertheless important for us to believe that, and to believe that Hashem's oneness, at least what we can understand is that it's not like our oneness. In other words, even when you talk about one ruler, one king, that's a king that's made up of components. We have to believe that God's oneness is totally in a totally different dimension than any oneness that can exist in this world. So He's a totally one and perfect being. Okay, and that's the Rambam's definition of what it means. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Okay. Now what I want to do is I want to take it to another level. Okay. Are we okay so far? Yeah? Okay. Now I'm going to take you to the mystical level of how Hashma works. So we have the halachic level. Halachic level is Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. We understand the translation of Hashem and Elokeinu. Echad means the only power and so on. We have the Rambam, that not just that He's the only power, but He's completely singular, whatever that means. And now we go to a deeper level. And a deeper level and this comes from the works of Kabbalah and Hasidic teachings and so on. That we learn that when we say the Shema, especially when we say it in davening, right? Shema is almost like the climax of davening. It's one of the climaxes of davening. Because it's a lead up. You know, the prayer is called a ladder. And it comes from the dream of Yaakov. When Yaakov fell asleep, it says he saw there was a dream, there was a ladder rooted in the ground, and Verosha Magia Shemayim, and its top reached the heavens. So the commentaries explain that's a metaphor for davening. Davening is a ladder. Davening goes in progression. The whole part of davening, the Sukkah, the Zimra, the Baruch Shema, Yishtabach, the blessings of Shema, and then the Shema, it's like a ladder climbing up the ladder, and we're becoming more and more connected as we go along, or so it should be, right? And it's a ladder which connects us, even though we might be very deeply rooted in the ground being a metaphor for coarseness or earthliness or materialism, but through davening we're able to progress, climb the ladder progressively and reach the ultimate level, which is Shema. Shema is when we reach complete connection with God. Why do we reach complete connection with God? Because we're going to go back to what the word Shema means, but let's just start with the word Echad. In Hasidic teachings, the word Echad takes on a whole other meaning. And the word Echad, which then explains why it needs to be done, why it needs to be taught so much, and why it needs to be repeated so much, is not that there's no other God, not that there's no other control, but the ultimate meaning of Hashem Echad is that there's no other existence, really. There's no other real existence other than God. Now, this is much more emphasized in a different pasuk. We say also in Aleinu. In Aleinu, we say, if you remember the verse, we say, V'yadaito hayoim, you should know today, ki Hashem hu alakim, Hashem is God, Hashemayim mal in the heavens above, al oretz mitochas, and in the earth below, ein oid, there's nothing else. Right? What does it mean there's nothing else? What that means is that the real meaning of Hashem Echad means that we know that the world is completely dependent on God's creation and recreation the entire time. Right? So there's a principle that the Baal Shem Tov explains that it is not true to say that when God created the world, He created the world in such a way where he created the world, he left it and it became a being. That's not true. But we say there's a pasuk in Tehillim which says, La'olam Hashem dvarcha nitzav bashamayim. Your words, Hashem, are always rooted in the heaven. What does that mean? So he explains the following. That when Hashem created the world, he created it with the tools of the 10 utterances, right? The words of the Torah, the words of the Alephase, are the vehicle which carry forth the spark of God, which gives life to every being. And that utterance of Hashem, for example, that said, Yehi Rokia, may there be a heaven, that utterance is continuous. It's a continuous force which recreates the heaven every single moment. And were it not to happen, the heavens would simply cease to exist. And therefore the Arizal explains that every single physical thing has a soul, has a spark of God on different levels. Some are more conscious, some are less conscious, right? But that spark of God is in that being every single moment, recreating it from nothing and making it exist. And were it to depart, it would simply cease to exist like it was before the 6 days of creation. What does that mean? Let's take it a bit further. So the explanation goes like this. I'll give you two analogies. One analogy is, let's say a smith takes a piece of silver and he forms it into a candelabra, right? And then he goes away. Now it's a candelabra, so he can go. He can leave, and it's fine. We may never know who the smith is, and the candelabra exists the way it is. Okay? Let me give you another analogy. Let's take a stone that you throw up in the air. We know that the natural default, the default nature of the world is gravity. So if you drop something, it will fall continuously. The only reason it stops is because something stops it, like a ground. But let's say if you went to a skyscraper and you threw the same thing down, it will just keep going until it hits something. So it will keep going infinitely until it stops. However, we know if you take a stone and you throw it upwards, it will go up, depending how strongly you threw it, and then it will come down. Why? Because where it works like this. When you throw down a stone, so the stone is consistent with its natural state. It's not a chidush, nothing new. There was nothing new, it'll continue to exist the way it exists. Correct? Therefore, it'll continue to go down because that's its default natural position. When you take a stone, you throw it upwards, the stone is now doing something which is against its nature. It's not its natural state. Okay? So its natural state is to go down, and now you're throwing it up. So how long will it go up for? So in order to go up, it needs a force, an intervening force, an invading force, to send the stone up. As long as the force, as we know the laws of physics, as long as the force is in the stone, depending on how strongly you put it in there, as long as that force is in the stone, it will continue to go up. The minute the force ceases to be there, it naturally drops. Okay? So why does the stone need the force to make it go up, where the candelabra doesn't need the smith to continuously create it? Very simple. Because when the smith creates a candelabra out of a piece of silver, he's not making anything new. The silver was there before. The concept of a candelabra was there before. Everything is there before. He's just changing its form from one form to another, both of which exist before. And therefore, he can now leave it. It's nothing supernatural. It's nothing against its nature. Okay? When the world was created, in Kabbalah, we learn like this. The Eitz Chaim says that before the world was created, what was the obvious existence? The obvious existence was the infinite expression of God. To use the language of Kabbalah, of mysticism, it says, before the world was created, Or Ein Sof, the light of God, filled all of existence, whatever that means. In other words, what was prior to the existence of the world, the default existence was God and infinite godliness. Okay. For a finite world, for a world that hides the existence of God and is finite, to exist is like taking a stone and throwing it upwards. It's not a natural default position of anything to exist. The natural state of existence is God. Okay? For a world to exist is like taking a, that's the analogy that's given, it's like taking a stone and throwing it upwards. And because it's like taking a stone and throwing it upwards, it is against the default existence, which is God. Therefore, but God willed that it should be, there should be a world, fine. But in order for it to exist, it needs a constant recreation. To the point that if it's not that way, that if he doesn't constantly recreate it, it will automatically go back to its default existence, which is God, and it won't be a world. Okay? Is that clear? Now let me take it a step further. Now you have to concentrate. Okay. When a bird flies, is that a flying creature? Yeah. You say a bird is a flying creature. That's a natural thing. Okay. Now, if I take a stone and throw it upwards, and the stone is flying, perhaps as fast as a bird, right? Let me ask you two questions. Is the stone flying? Yes. No, it is. It's going upwards. Let's say that's considered flying. Is it flying? Yes. Would you call it a flying stone? No. So it is flying, but it's not a flying stone. Why not? Because it's flying, it's not his. It's not the stone's. The stone is flying, but its total flying is dependent on something else. So it is flying. It's not an illusion. It's flying, right? But you can't call it a flying stone. Okay? Now let's take the world. Does the world exist? Absolutely. Why do I know that? Because it says in the Torah it exists. What do you mean? You can't say it's illusion. It's not imagination. Right? By the way, I'm not making that up. It says that like that. It says how you know the world really exists, because it says in the Torah. The Torah says, Bereishis bara Elokim, God created the world. Right? The Torah is the Torah of truth. No, but on a serious note, the world exists. Is it an independently existing world?
No.
No. Because its entire existence is completely dependent on the energy of God that's giving it life. Understand? The stone is flying, but is it a flying stone? No. The world exists. Does the world have an independent existence? No. It's a deep idea, this. Sorry? No, it's an analogy. In other words, it's an analogy when something happens to something that's not its default position. Like in a stone, like within the world, a bird flies, so you can call it a flying stone. That's part of a flying bird. That's part of the innate existence of a bird. A stone doesn't fly. If you make it fly, it's flying. It's not a flying stone. Because it's flying is not its thing. It's completely hinges on something else, on a force that's making it fly. Well, that's the limited force. God's force is not limited. That's our force, because that's why it stops to fly after a while. The world exists. Does the world independently exist? No. So therefore, what is the only absolute true existence? God. And that's Hashem Echad. I think I once told you this before. Reb Zalman Serebransky was a great chassid. He lived in Melbourne, and he used to say, "You know why the dalet of Echad is big?" You say Yiddish, it sounded better. He said, "Because it's shaped like an axe." So you've got to knock the Echad into your head. He says it doesn't happen once. It takes time to come. This is a very, very difficult thing to comprehend. Even more difficult is to live by it. And to live by it and to really internalize it. Okay? Because God created a world by design, but that reality is completely not obvious. Correct? Completely not obvious. Not even obvious in an intellectual way. What I mean to say is, it's not. Even a person doesn't understand these things, it's not hard to come to a conclusion that there is a God that created a world. That's not, you don't see God, you don't feel Him, but that can become an obvious concept at least. Right? Because it doesn't go against our very being. In other words, for any human being or anything to come to the conclusion that, I am who I am, and I didn't make myself, so someone made me. Okay, so God made me, God controls me, God has the authority, and all that, that's something that can, that's understood. But to understand the real meaning of Echad, that there actually is really no other true, real existence, and our existence is completely part of his existence. It's the stone is flying only because of another force, and therefore it's not a flying stone, it's not an existing world, it's part of God's existence. It only exists because of God's will, and were it not to be for that spark of God, we would just become nothing, and therefore is only really one true reality. That's not an obvious thing. Which is why, on a deeper level, the ayin and the dalet are bigger. I'll tell you an amazing concept. We said, the idea is edus, to say testimony, right? There's a concept in Gemara, I see we're not going to get anywhere near where I wanted to get, it doesn't matter, okay, we'll have to leave a different time. But there's a concept in Gemara that, what's the definition of a witness, halachic definition of a witness, right? When a witness comes to court to testify, he's testifying about something that's not known. Something that's avida legluya, something that is obvious, you don't need testimony for. Right? If it's obvious, then the court doesn't need testimony. Just everyone, if it's an obvious piece of knowledge, then everyone knows that it exists. You don't need someone to come formally testify, it's a known concept. So what's the definition of an aid? What's the definition of a witness? Someone who can testify about something that is not known to most people, but he's known to the witness, so he reveals it to everyone else. That's the halachic definition of testimony. So to say Shema Yisrael because we're testifying about God's existence, the fact that there is a God, you don't need a witness for. A witness is to testify about something that's hidden, something that's not obvious. But when we understand that Hashem Echad is about revealing the infinity of God, revealing the true existence of God, not how God relates to and created a finite world where he hides himself. That's sort of how God has contracted himself, hidden himself, lowered himself. But how God in his true existence, and in God in his true existence, there that is only one reality. Hashem Echad means there's no. That's the only true reality. To bring that deeper dimension of consciousness of godliness into the world, that's why we have an ayin and dalet. That's why we say the Shema. And that's also the meaning of Hashem Elokeinu. Why? Because we know that Kabbalistically, the different names of Hashem, as I said, express different levels of godliness. But the word Hashem, Yud-Kei and Vav-Kei, always represents the infinity of God. Right? Elokeinu, which Elokim, that represents how God is hidden. What we call in Kabbalah the concept of Tzimtzum. Which is why the name of Elohim has the same gematria, I've mentioned this before, as Hateva, nature. What is nature? Nature is that mechanism that hides the existence of God. Because it's the routine mechanism of the world where we just expect the sun to come up from the east and set in the west and the crops to grow and so on and so forth, where we can come to an unfortunate mistake that God's power is not there. Right? So we have Hashem Elokim. Hashem is God's true existence, infinite existence, his unlimited existence. Elokeinu is more our limited existence, how Hashem relates, how Hashem has hidden himself into the world being finite beings. When we say Shema Yisrael, we say Hashem Elokeinu. That the goal is to make Hashem Elokeinu. To make our existence express the infinity of God. Without saying the Shema, without going through this process, Elokim is Elokim and Hashem is Hashem. If you look at the 6 days of creation, you only find the word of Elokim, Bereshit Bara Elokim, or Yomer Elokim, etc., etc. Why? Because that's God working in a way where he's hidden. Our job is to take that existence and bring God's true presence into that existence. Hashem Elokeinu. Take the Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the infinity of God, the revelation of God, into the Elokeinu, into the world where he's hidden. How do you do that? You do that through the word Shema. Shema, that's why that's deeply the meaning of the word Shema. Shema has many meanings. First of all, Shema means to not just listen. Shema means to internalize. I think I've told this before in Yiddish. My father always used to say this to me. In Yiddish, there's two words to listen. Hair and der hair. Hair means to biologically listen to something. So I heard it, the sound waves came to my ears. Der hair means to internalize it. It's different, right? I mentioned my father because he would always tell me something, then he wasn't sure if I was really listening. So he would say, Derhest. Did he hear? I'll say, yeah. He said, do Derhest? Hair is not enough. Did you internalize what I'm telling you? Right? So that's the concept. How do we do that? We do it not just by saying the Shema, but by reflecting and learning and contemplating and thinking, which goes back to the Ayin and Dalit. Because Ayin and Dalit mean aid, mean witness. But if you change around the letters, the Dalit and the Ayin also mean Da, to know. Da comes from the word from Da'at. And we know that in the powers of understanding, we have Chachma, Bina, and Da'at, right? And they all mean different things. The word Da'at means to know well, to connect yourself to it, to internalize it, to think about it. Shema is not just a sentence we say. Shema is something we need to think about, we need to reflect about, we need to really deeply internalize. Okay. Just to finish off, now we can understand an interesting thing. We just read on Tisha B'Av, actually. We read the very, very tragic and sad story about the 10 martyrs, right? The one of them was Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was brutally tortured to death. And when he was tortured to death, it says, we say in the kinnus of Tisha B'Av, we mentioned again on Yom Kippur, that he was saying Shema. And it says, Yatzeso nishmasoi be'echad. His neshama left him with the word Echad, when he said Hashem Echad, right? And since then, it's always been a tradition, and we know this, unfortunately, in the Shoah, in the Holocaust, where many, many, many people went to their deaths very confidently, but they had the sentence of Shema Yisrael. They screamed out, Shema Yisrael. Right? You know, even generally, when a person passes away, if they're able, if they're conscious enough, and they know the end is coming near, they say the Shema. Why is that? Why is Shema synonymous with self-sacrifice? We know throughout, especially when people have to give up their life for God, it was always got to do with the Shema Yisrael. And it's also the pasuk, the first pasuk, one of the first pasuk can we teach children. So it's the pasuk you live with, it's the pasuk you die with, right? Why? And when else do we say this pasuk with great emphasis? At the end of Yom Kippur. You know, that we scream out, the Shema Yisrael, Hashem Lakein, Hashem Lachod, right? It's not just about that these are the times we affirm our belief in God. It's much more than that. Because this concept, the deeper meaning of Shema, is not just a concept. The deep meaning of Shema, that nothing really truly exists outside of God's true existence, should, if we think about it enough and learn about it enough and contemplate enough and daven with it enough, it should motivate us to serve God properly. It should motivate us to make our whole being God-centered. Because at the end of the day, every other existence is insignificant. The only true, real existence is God. So if I want to connect to my true existence, I want to connect to something that really, truly exists, and have a true, meaningful, proper existence, it's about a connection to God. Anything that is not a connection to God really has very weak, it's just a weak existence. Right? And that's why the great tzaddikim, or the Yidden, when they were pushed, or at the end of Yom Kippur particularly, when we had a great day of holiness, and we tried to imbue our entire existence with the belief of God and the connection to God, we come to a level at the end of Yom Kippur where we can truly scream out Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, where we can mean Hashem Echad, maybe more than we mean on a regular day. On a regular day, we can know what it means, but maybe at the end of Yom Kippur, or those tragic circumstances with Rabbi Akiva when he gave up his life, to him, because if it was a choice between serving an idol or not learning Torah, or not going with what the Romans wanted to do, or giving up his life, he gave up his life. Why? Because to him, there was nothing else. Nothing else existed besides God. But the important things to understand is not about giving up our life, because the same pasuk we teach to a child when they start talking. Because the ultimate purpose is not to die with Shema Yisrael, the ultimate purpose is to live with the Shema Yisrael. Right? Dying with Shema Yisrael is one thing, but living with Shema Yisrael is even harder in a way. Sometimes when the adrenaline of the soul comes out, when throughout history when people were pushed, they sang Shema Yisrael and they jumped into the fire. But the greater challenge is to live with the Shema Yisrael. It's to make our lives around the fact that the only true existence is God and godliness, and to live our lives that way. Which means live a life which is full of Hashem's values and full of Hashem's mitzvahs and serving Him and thinking at any time in our life. What is it? What I'm doing, is it consistent with His will and the values which He taught me? Which is a purely physical life and all the things that we do, but it's about channeling it in a way where we live by His values. And that's our aspiration, that's the goal that we try and talk about with Seh Hashem Echad. I was going to go into Baruch Shem and Vahavta, but I have to leave that for a different time.
Thank you.